So we started something last night. we embarked on the first of the three. It's a very odd sounding. Does it sound echoey or funny? It does to me. Like my ears, I'm in an airplane. And my ears are blocked.
It sounds clearer than last night.
Oh, it does?
More
trouble, yeah. Okay. It's sounding better. A little bit better. Yeah. Okay, I can do it like this. Thanks, Peter. So we started. We're going to do two more investigations tonight. Last night we began an investigation into the singularity of things. The singularity of things means, I was just telling my friends a joke where this guy walks into a bar and he walks up to a lady and says, "Are you singular?" I thought we could make a little comic or t-shirt out of that. Anyway, she should do that investigation. She might find something there. Anyways, so, you know, why do we... It's still kind of feedback-y. Did you hear this weird echo?
It's
okay, thank you, Peter. Yeah, it's kind of strange. Good, I think that's, yeah, no, it's, yeah, that's good, thanks. Yeah, it's more normal, whatever that means.
That's what we want.
Yeah, we want a little bit normal at least. So the reason we look into the singularity, it's a way of looking into things. We see everything in things. So we see our beliefs in things. We see our fear as a thing. You know, I'm afraid. Like, there's this idea that there's something there. So the reason we're doing these investigations, you know, is, like I was saying last night, to see that we're not really doomed, basically. We're not doomed. We're not stuck. That we don't have to feel like that we're trapped in how we think the world is. And we have a lot of belief systems that keep us very bound. In a certain way of seeing ourselves and others, and so there's another way of understanding who we are, and I think this will become clear also tonight with the investigations that we have to do, and so we start the whole thing of the Buddha Dharma is we just start to ask questions, we just start to touch it a little bit, we start to touch our experience and look inside. And I was thinking of the analogy of, you know, like a, I don't know if you like Terry Gross, NPR Fresh Air. I really always like her. I think she's very masterful. And you can turn on the radio and you're not even interested in the person she's interviewing or what he or she does. But as soon as Terry starts asking those questions, it's just like it keeps opening and opening and it enriches somehow life. It informs you. But it's not like you ever get to know that person in a determinate way. But some kind of you're it's the process that's kind of awake. You know, when we're asking questions, we're not closing down around conclusions, and yet we're very engaged in life. So doesn't that sound like a good place to live to you? To me, it's where I want to live. And I often use the example of my teacher Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, because when I first met him, I was very young, and I walked into the room and I had a lot of expectations. You know, I heard so much about him, and Khyentse Rinpoche told me so much about him, and I thought, you know, I had this image of kind of this wise man who knew everything, you know, like how you see in the movies with the beard and the specs and all that. And I walked in and I found this human being that was in a state of complete awe all the time, just amazed by life and totally alive. Like, not shut down and knowing in any way. It was so palpable how awake and engaged he was and how much he was not a knower, even though he had studied, you know, all the great, the texts from all the great lineages, and he'd done years and years of retreat in the cave. He was very knowledgeable, but the way he worked with knowledge or the way he was in the world, his being just embodied this spirit of the open question. And that's when I kind of understood, oh, this is where this path goes. And that's why I think that's just continued for me. And I've realized more and more how much that's actually the case, because it is a path of inquiry. So, you know, a lot of this is how do we look, and how do we move also out of this sense of vagueness? Because actually, when you listen to Terry Gross, what you do is you might hear this person's name, but as they're having this conversation, you understand more and more about him, not in a determinate way, but you're more informed, or there's more richness to who he was or she was after the interview. So it's not a vague situation at all. You're actually moving from kind of an abstract idea or a name into this whole world of interdependence, and you come out of it with some richness and having yourself been engaged in something. So I really think, you know, this the process of investigation that we do here, it's not something just to do and just say, oh, I know, I couldn't find, you can't find anything, like reach a conclusion. It's a conviction that comes from really seeing it and actually realizing this is kind of where you want to live. This it puts you in the mind of an open question. It places you in that kind of open place of open inquiry, which is so alive and so engaged. And so, like I was saying last night, you know, some of these really exploratory scientists, they enjoy the process. So it's often the process is like the fruition of it. And when you look at a belief and you see that you know, you can't find anything intrinsic there, like you can't find a singular thing that you call the self, or a singular thing that you can say, this is my pain or my life, or it, there's a liberation that happens from that. A very direct one, not just the conceptual. Of course, the conceptual mind understands something, but really from the depth of your being, because we hold beliefs in our physiology. You know, beliefs are not just conceptual. Beliefs permeate our entire being, as you know. So this is very important. Now, before I start the inquiry, Amy's question kind of haunted me a little bit last night and this morning. I'm not 100% sure I know what it is, but I want to make sure that somehow I felt this something, you were asking something subtle, and you can pursue it after each investigation. We'll have a little discussion. Pursue it a little more if we're not getting at it. But I did want to say, it made me want to say one thing about the nature of experience. So I don't know if this is getting at it or not. It might be. But what we call experience, you know, what are we looking at, or what are we, you could use the word observe, or put your attention on, put your awareness on. You can almost say feel at times, but be aware of. Where is your awareness? So what we're putting our awareness on is our experience. Now, what is experience? Is something that arises every moment based on causes and conditions. So due to, you know, infinite numbers of causes and conditions, we have physical experiences or emotional experiences. We're perceiving things. Thoughts are arising. There's a lot of things going on, but you can never get away from experience. So you actually don't even have to conjure up experience. Even if you live in a cave, you're still going to have the ground beneath you. You're going to need food. You're going to experience your body, and you're going to have all kinds of experiences. So there's no way around experience, which is good, because this is what makes us alive, is that we're experiencing our world. So when we're doing these investigations, sometimes we're bringing our mind to specific experiences. So last night, you know, we were looking at some sensations in our body, for example, and trying to find something singular. So when we put our attention on something, usually it kind of comes to life. Like if you're getting body work done, Gina was doing some of her wonderful Ayurvedic practice with me the other day, and she would put her hand in a certain area and just ask me to put my attention there and see what was going on. So, you know, there'd be like a flurry of sensation, and something would open up. And maybe there would be a story that opens up, or maybe there would be a emotion that opens up, or something, you know, there's always something, and it doesn't really matter, like, the content. It's just, especially in this practice, we're not looking to grab onto content. What we're looking at is, what is the nature of the experience itself? You know, can you actually find it? Can you point to something singular? So, you know, we're always paying attention to the content, like, what, or impute meaning upon it. But here we're not doing that. We're just letting it open up, you know, and enjoying it, and seeing what's there without kind of holding on or thinking, oh, this is like the truth, or this is the conclusion of who I am, or this is a... So it's very simple in a certain way. A lot of times when we're asked to self-reflect or investigate it within ourself, it means we look at our psychology or our experience, and we don't want to look, because when we look, we think, oh, I really am a failure after all. Like, that's being honest with yourself, is that you look inside and you see a lot of faults, you know, or something like of that nature. This is not what we're talking about here at all. As a matter of fact, in this tradition, we don't have that kind of aggression toward our experience. We're actually really looking into the nature of our experience. And I also want to say that when we're looking, we might think, you know, usually we look outside, but here we're looking inside. But that's not what I'm saying. Because we usually think of inside experience, that we have inner experiences as thoughts and emotions and so forth. But in fact, when you really look at it, those kind of experiences come at us as an object. Like, oh God, I felt that pain of that. Or, you know, like, the experiences are actually an object of our awareness. So the awareness is kind of like the subject, and the object is, you know, like our, just the thoughts that we notice or our perceptions that we take in. So it's not really that there's an inside or an outside on a certain way. That's an artificial kind of boundary. In fact, a lot of the experiences we have come from our intercourse with the world. So sometimes we think the external phenomena, looking outside, has to do with whatever is outside the boundaries of our body. But in fact, you can't separate inside and outside. For example, you know, I wouldn't have a perception of these glasses or experience of these glasses without the glasses, and vice versa. You know, the things arise interdependently. So we have this tendency to think, oh, Dharma, we're looking in. And we get sometimes a little bit too inward facing. They say, don't do that. Or we could just kind of focus outside and get distracted, and they say, don't be so outward facing. But in fact, everything is equal in the way that it arises. It arises interdependently, and it's always expressing itself and dissolving. Whether it's a so-called perception or a so-called, you know, experience of an object that we consider outside, it's all kind of the same in the nature. So it's okay to use those terms, inner and outer, like look at your body, that might be an inner experience, or look at your thoughts, or imagine something. You know, we might consider that an inner experience, but even our imagination is based on our intercourse with our life and our outer experiences. And it's hard really to say, is imagination inside or outside? You know, these things are just gross ways or coarse ways that we think things are, but when we start to look. So you don't have to get fixated inside or outside, you know. We could experience is going to continue to arise, and sometimes we focus it on particular things. So when we're focusing on the body, then we bring the awareness to the body. When we're focusing on, you know, maybe visualization, we bring it to the visualization. The mind is so agile. We can do so many things with this. So we're experimenting, and, you know, I say we're using our imagination, but really everything is our imagination, you know. Everybody in this room is looking at me in this moment and hearing a different thing and seeing me in a different way, you know? So it can't be I'm some kind of intrinsically true thing if everybody sees me differently, you know? And so on, you know? So these are all really interesting things to keep in mind. I don't know if that's at all addressing Amy's question, but we're going to continue on, and other things might come up, but it just sparked in me a need to say a few more words about what it means to investigate things. This is all so rich, isn't it? How we see things, how we look at things, what does it mean to look with an open mind without grasping or rejection, without concluding or affirming or negating something, you know, how, or putting it down, judging something, you know? You think we can do that? Is there a possible way of seeing things without affirming or denying them? Do you think? Yeah, this is what we're asking, and then we're experimenting and seeing how agile our mind can be. And then these are beautiful investigations because they'll take you through. Like, you don't have to worry too much. Just follow my lead, kind of thing. Because I'm just following the lead of Nagarjuna or the Buddha or Chandrakirti. No, I'm following their lead. And when I have, they've never led me astray. So I feel very comfortable doing this because I feel like I'm backed by an entire lineage, which gives me a lot of confidence. Like, this is not mine. It's only mine in that I've done it, and I have complete conviction in it, I think. But it's something that's been passed down. So I'm very humbled also by this situation. So anyways, we looked into if could we find something that was singular, and that to me is the hardest one. So tonight we're going to look at something else that has to do with time or continuum and seeing if there's something that continues. So we're going to look and see if we can find something that's either permanent or impermanent. Again, we're looking for a thing. We're always looking for a thing. Anything we can find that we can say, aha, there it is. Again, we don't have to get, it's not even really, we need to get heavily intellectual in the sense that philosophical about it. All we need to do is be very direct in the way we look. So, what I want to investigate with this particular investigation I'm looking in to see if we can find something permanent or impermanent is if we can find a continuous self, a self that continues. That has to do with continuing, right? Something that continues. So oftentimes, I'm sure everyone's had this experience at one time or another, you pick up a baby picture and you just think, wow, you know, a lot has changed since then. A lot has changed since then. And it's very obvious that things are impermanent. Your body is completely different. Like, what do they say? Like, every 7 years, you don't even have one cell that was you had back then. And you've matured, and you've learned how to function, and your whole world is different on some level. At the same time, well, there is some sort of continuum. You can't say you're the same, but you can't completely say you're different, right? Like, I always think I was the one who was, like, grabbing onto my mom's skirt the first day of nursery school. I was that one. And I kind of remember it. I am the one who's witnessed my life story firsthand. I've seen patterns throughout my life. Like, I've always liked horses for some reason. Or I've always had a curiosity about what creates happiness and what creates suffering since I was very little. And I had a connection there's something bigger. So I pursued that. And there seemed to be a continuum in that way. Or I've always had the same name and the same parents, so to speak. Or I'm like, I keep narrating the same story. Like, I got jilted once. And I'm the one who, the story keeps, I'm narrating it again and again and having the similar experiences again and again based on something I didn't work out, you know. So there's a strong feeling of I. So it's kind of like we're asking, what is this impermanent thing? What is this thing that keeps changing? Because on one way we see, oh, it's very obvious we're impermanent, but obviously there's something that is impermanent for us. So this is why we need to dig a little bit deeper. because this sense of a self that doesn't change is very deep in us in a very vague way. In a very vague way. And I always think all day long, how many times do we think me, myself, I, with such great confidence that we know what we're talking about? It's a little bit like that here that we never see. You know, we're always referring to it and we feel it. We feel the tug of it. When something doesn't go our way, we feel the pain of that. When something happens that we like, we feel the joy of that, you know? So there's this kind of presence or sense of me all the time. So we need to look into this. And so this is what we're going to do just now. So we're just going to jump right into the investigation just now. So let's just do, we have to do two investigations. So we'll just do, we'll just watch our breath, bring our attention to our breath for a few minutes. And then I'll guide you through this. So begin by bringing your attention or your questioning mind to this notion of self. And I'm not going to say exactly where you should look, but just see where your mind takes you when you think of the self. You might feel it somewhere physically, like a presence. You could try to locate that. Or some thoughts might come to your mind. It might switch around a lot too, or you might have a visual image of that, or just might be a sensing, an intuitive sense, or something you feel physically, a sense. And try to put words to it, just to yourself. Try to put words to it. I'm going to give you just a few words as an example, because some times I've asked people and they've told me with how they've experienced it. For example, you might feel, you know, a strong kind of tight sensation in your chest. It feels like the self that's a little bit frozen or contracted. Or you might feel a sense of confidence, openness too. Someone once described it as kind of a presence, like white noise in the background, like your neighbor's radio, or like a narrator. You might hear your voice like a narrator, you know, narrating your story. Or a critic. Try to put words to that. And see if this particular thing that you find, is it static or inert, or does it keep changing one thing to another? Can you kind of catch it? Can you hold on to it? And ask yourself too, is this self that's looking, is the self the one that's looking in and trying to find, or the one being looked at? Maybe it's both. And can you find one inside or outside that you can say is a self that's permanent or unchanging? So you might, if you can't find a self that's permanent that you can point to, you might just see many different things happening, and you might think, well, maybe it's like an actor that keeps putting on different costumes, but the actor is the same. But then if it keeps changing, how can you say that it's one thing, one permanent thing? Many people wonder, well, I think that its consciousness must be the self, because all these other things are changing. So what's that who is aware must be the self. Consciousness must be the self, awareness. Kind of like a camera in a bank that picks up lots of information, but the awareness itself doesn't seem to change. But ask yourself this, is it true that awareness doesn't change, or does awareness change with what it perceives? Does awareness change with its world, with its experience? Or is awareness some kind of blank thing that you experience? Can you find this self that doesn't change with experience? One good thing to visualize that might be helpful is like a mirror. We often say, oh, well, the mirror doesn't change, but the objects in front of the mirror change, like whatever comes in front of the mirror changes. But in fact, the mirror does change based upon what's put in front of it. So the definition of a mirror is to reflect images. So whatever's put in front of the mirror, then it reflects on the mirror, and the mirror reflects that, and it changes the nature or the quality of the mirror. So we can't say a mirror doesn't change, or it's not in, or that it exists independently, or it doesn't have a relationship with the things that move in front of it. So then you might ask or wonder, well, self does seem kind of like a stream of momentary experiences, like beads on a necklace. Discrete experiences, and it most certainly seems to have some cohesion. You know, things seem to have cohesion. That little person in the picture seems to have cohesion and continuum with who you are now, how you see yourself now. So I want to look a little bit, or I want you to look, at how experience arises. Does experience really arise in discrete units, discrete moments? For example, when we think of the continuum of our experience, and we think moment, we think like a tick of a clock. We think we look through the lens of time. So we all see through time, because this is an agreement that we have. We think of things in terms of past, present, future, minutes, seconds, hours, years, and so forth. But do we actually experience in terms of moments? Look and see. Is it like duck, duck, duck? Is that how you see your experience? Is it broken up like that? Look at it directly. Don't look at it through the lens of a clock, but really look very directly at that. We were talking about this last night, how time is a construct. That time is something we manage as a way to work elegantly, you know, together in society, and make some kind of order in our society or in our family or in the world, to create some sort of order and functionality. So let's look at this idea of a moment, a discrete moment, a separate moment. See if you can capture a moment. Maybe you can try to capture a past moment. But when you look at the past, most likely you'll see it's already gone. And if you want to capture a future moment, most likely it hasn't come yet. That's what makes it the future moment. So try to look at a present moment. Can you kind of capture it or identify it? Or does this moment also, what you look at as a moment, have a past, present, and future? Does it also have a continuum? In fact, when we're looking at continuum, we often think we're looking at time, but what we're really looking at is change. How things change, how our experience continues to change. So I want to challenge you to look and see if you can find anything change. I know that that sounds impossible, but imagine this. This is a very traditional analogy in the Vajrayana, where if you have like a clear surface of a lake and you draw a line on the water, things seem to arise and dissolve at the same time. So in one way you can see, I saw a line, but you can't see the continuum of that. You don't see something arise, express itself, and fall away, and it doesn't leave a trace. So I'm going to ask you a few questions. Can you identify where the night becomes the dawn? Do we see that change, that moment where night becomes the dawn? Or can you identify when the daylight becomes the dusk? Or the dusk becomes the night. Of course, this is something you can only do in your imagination right now, but you can actually stand outside, you know, at a certain period of the day, and you can say, oh, it's dark now, or oh, it's still light. But it would be very interesting to try to look up at the sky and see if you could find that time. I do it quite often when we're trying to figure out what times to do the cities during our Drupchu. And I have everybody go outside and say when they think it happened. Everybody has a completely different time. You can't really find that exact or I won't say, we haven't been able to find that exact moment. So let me ask you this. This is for the parents, I guess. You know, could you identify that moment where your infant became a toddler? Or your toddler became a child? Or your child became a teenager? Like sometimes when they're a teenager, they'll do something and it hits you, oh, they're a teenager. Mm-hmm. But what, could you ever point to that precise moment? Or for some of us, when did I start getting old? When did I get old? Can you identify that moment? Can you single out that moment? Do we experience change in that way? Can we say, oh, this is when one thing changed into another? Do we actually see that with our direct perception? Just think about that for a minute. Really bring that to your mind or your imagination, that do you actually see something change, one thing into another? Now bring your mind back to your breath. So I thought we could just open this up for discussion for a little bit, and then we'll move on to the next one. That seemed like the best way to do it, I thought. this is a very traditional, in a certain way, a very, I put my own twist on it, but it's a very traditional way of looking at things. In fact, in the tradition of Majjhimaka, you look at the, trying to find the sprout if it's to a seed. You spend hours and hours and hours trying to identify where a sprout, if you actually see a sprout turn into a seed. People think it's very, this kind of fussy investigation because it's so minute, but in fact it's utterly fascinating because you really can't. And there's a lot of logic about it, but we don't have time to go over all the logic, but I actually think it's very powerful to just simply not see it, you know, like the dawn and the night and the dawn. Really spend a lot of time outside observing, looking. I haven't found, but I'm curious to see what your experience is, and then I'll say a few more things about this and then we'll move on to the next one. So this is the one about, can you find anything that's permanent or impermanent? Can you find a thing that you see changing?
Existence.
Well, what is that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just isness. It's changing.
What is isness?
Being.
What is that? Can you find that as a thing that you could point
to?
Well, yeah, that's what's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting that we're having experiences, you know, and yet when we look very directly, we can't find this kind of thingness, like one thing changing into another thing. Unless you found, did you find isness? Or is it something that's like, this is now, so we can't say again, that it exists, or you can say it, you find a permanent thing there, and yet you can't say that you're experiencing nothing, right? So it's kind of has this illusory quality to it, right? Is that some? Yeah. It's a different way of looking at things, isn't it? And it's not to say, it's not a refutation of experience. For example, if you went to a farmer and said, have you ever really looked and you could see that the sprout, you can't see a sprout come from a seed. Like, when you really look, you can't find that kind of continuum or connection. They'll ask you, you know, where you're going to get your produce from. Do you know what I mean? You don't have to say it. So the interesting thing is just, it's very incredible how things are illusory in this way. So you can't affirm them, but you can't deny them, you know? And so this thing we call self and we cling to and we hold to, something like in a certain sense, you know, we can say it's functional, but we never really see one. Permanent self. We can't say we're the same as we were when we were little, but we can't say we're different either. Yeah.
So, a couple of interesting things happened for me. I mean, on the one hand, it was just a sense of like, wow, how much, you know, we kind of maybe even gotten used to living our lives in a quite vague way. Right, to sort of understand things as vague, like, oh, it's night, and at some point it turned into night.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it turned into morning. You know, so we're just kind of living this, you know, accepting kind of that vagueness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then the other interesting thing that when it happened was, you know, I'm sort of looking for the self. And so I'm there, and then, you know, just very clearly, you know, I'm hearing your words coming in there. So in my investigation, there's your voice right in there. And it just... It was so clear to me how I'm very vague about, you know, the thoughts that I have are ostensibly my thoughts, but really these thoughts are coming from things that I've learned over time. They're in English because that's the language that I've learned, and so and your voice was in there, so that's part of, you know, what will then become a thought later or something. But it was just became very clear how all those thoughts are not me. I mean, how I'm just sort of
mm-hmm.
vaguely assuming that that's me, but
yeah,
it's really from all these conditions and sort of this coming together.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions or beliefs about how things are, or just not looking deeply into the nature of things. At the same time, we can use these labels. Like, the labels aren't the problem, really. The labels are wonderful. There's this whole functionality around the labels and, you know, knowing who we are, so to speak, and it's like the functionality of come here. Works beautifully. We function well with it. And we can know that it doesn't have any kind of intrinsic truth to it. And yet it's working and functioning and arising in dependence upon other things. So we start to understand the nature of who we are. Yeah. It's interesting because Gina and I were having a talk this morning because Gina has trouble with vagueness in a certain way, which is to her advantage in this study. She keeps saying, what does real mean? You keep using the word real. Or what does look mean? But this is kind of interesting because we have a lot of assumptions around these words. And so we keep opening them up. It's not like we'll ever reach a definitive definition of real or a definitive definition of anything. But it's just a way of opening it up, you know, and learning more about ourselves. So again, it's like this continued ability to bear this process of learning and openness, you know. Peter, do you?
I just thought that exercise with time about trying to find a click of time
yeah.
was extremely effective in creating that sense of openness. It only took a few moments of suggestion
yeah.
and to try it, to have this experience of everything just opens up. And
yeah.
and for me, I could just see how normally I'm trapped by the notions of past, present, future. But when you actually, it's actually, that's one of the easier ones, I think, because it just opens things up so tremendously.
Yeah. It's a powerful investigation. Yeah.
I'm finding temperature is an interesting one.
Temperature.
Yeah, because it's like there's not a it's so relative. There's not a moment. When does it become hot?
Yeah, that's
cold?
A good one.
And then being at a time when hot flashes are a regular part of my meditation experience, I realize there's not a thing about it. It's like it's sort of, there's not a moment that it's this or that. It continues to arise and change. And it's really interesting. But since the temperature keeps shifting in here, that's been an interesting point for me to open up some things.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Notice when does it get cold or when did it get warm?
Especially in this room. It can be like Arctic or tropical within the span of 5 minutes.
Yeah, it doesn't stop anywhere in between.
Yeah, you see, it's very, but it must, like, at some point go in the middle, but I couldn't identify that.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're just noticing that you're feeling hot. Exactly. It's not a complaint, by the way. Yeah.
I was noticing that about the sensation of, well, the fan is coming down and you can feel it kind of moving.
Yeah.
So, like, sort of in the vague impressions when we're moving along and not examining, it's just kind of like, oh, I feel a breeze. But you can actually feel, like, its whole journey.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, this is how this brings you alive. Do you see how that works? How it brings you alive?
Uh-huh.
It just brings you alive in some way. Into your awareness, into your connection with other things. I was so happy this morning. Somebody wrote me a little on my Facebook thing or email. They wrote that he said that he'd been had a very traumatic life with a lot of addiction. And he didn't realize until we had a weekend in Rochester, we were doing investigations, and he was saying, I never realized that I could even get out of my suffering. Like, I didn't ever realize it wasn't real before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I'm sure there's a lot of habitual patterns that are continue to arise, but just have that moment. I'll tell you one story that just came to my mind just now. I had a friend who got into a really bad marriage, and the husband was beating her. Like, she was in this marriage for 30 years, if you can imagine. And she said that she let it continue because she felt worthless and she thought she deserved it. Like, there's a belief, right? And our beliefs seem very real to us. And then somewhere 15 years in, she just had this moment where everything opened up. And she realized what she calls the truth of who she was. I don't know. It just means she stepped outside that story. And then it took another 15 years for her kind of extricate herself from that situation. It was just so enmeshed, you know? But it's so interesting how that's what this is. It's like you start looking at things and realizing, oh, wow, I'm not stuck. I'm not doomed. There is a whole other way to see this. You know, it's not as kind of solid, permanent, singular as I imagined it to be. So that's why we're doing this, because in the same way that you're feeling the air, we can feel our fear. We can feel our doom, where we feel like we're doomed, or we can feel our attachment or our aversion or our negativity, you know, our confusion in the very same way. It's like, is that really a truth? Can you find something there that's singular? We can call confusion. It's like as vague as like isness, you know, or confusion. Try to find all those things, you know, and it's not a denial of the experience of them. But it's simply understanding that they're illusory quality. And that my friend has a business card. She's a therapist and says, suffering is temporary, you know. But so this is, how do we become more savvy about our experience? Because we're reacting all over the place. And we're caught in something. So this is really a very practical exercise. And it's something that you develop conviction in. So when you're caught in something, you realize, oh, wait a minute. First, it might hit you intellectually. Oh, right, I remember. I looked and I couldn't find, you know, anything, a thing or a self or a. And then you give it a little space and start to feel like, feel that it's not this singular thing, but it's a lot of sensation. Like you're saying, it starts to come alive in a different way. You know, what is something like so-called grief? We're having this talk. Like when, you know, Peter and I were talking, like just the experience of having someone pass away or loss has so many incredible aspects to it. Like sometimes it feels really dark. Sometimes it feels, you feel tremendous love and appreciation. Sometimes you feel this kind of stillness, I don't know, that comes up, right? This kind of really deep peace or wide open. I don't know why that is, but some people say that they feel that. Sometimes it just makes you reflect so deeply on who you are and like the pettiness of your life that you get caught up in. You know, so what is grief but you start looking into it and it will continue to open, but we think we're stuck in something. Maybe you all don't because you're practicing. Then you'll see that when some, you know, but it's true. Like, there's a difference between people who have kind of investigated and those who don't, who think death is a horrible thing. Oh, it's awful. How can you reduce something so profound and poignant to just saying it's awful? You know, so here we're not allowing ourselves just to close down around those experiences. So it really is an enlivening, like you're saying. It makes you feel and experience and, you know, not just be caught in your concepts, but really have a full, rich opening, continued opening experience. So now we have one more investigation to go. This one's, I'll do a lot of talking and it's kind of fun. It's just playful. And so that the third investigation has to do, the question is, can you find anything that's not, that hasn't arisen due to causes and conditions or isn't influenced by other elements? So one way we might talk about this is, can you find anything that's independent or autonomous? That's not in relationship with anything else. Do you think you could find? Can you think of anything offhand that doesn't arise due to causes and conditions, or that isn't influenced or perceived? Then you couldn't even perceive it if it wasn't in relationship, right? So that's the question, and maybe there's a kind of a sub question in that. Can you find anything that? Well, I'll get to, no, this is, might be too abstract until the end. Okay. So, in the sutras, the Buddha talks a lot about how everything is interdependent. And he has this famous quote that we actually were walking by a Buddhist center today and we saw. Something like, this being that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that becomes not. From the cessation of this, or the ceasing of this, that ceases. Everything is interdependent. I say everything leans. That's what I call it. Everything leans against everything else. Everything is interdependent or interconnected. This is big in Buddhism, as you might know. And the Buddha had an illustration of this in the sutras where he had two, like a bundle of reeds here and a bundle of reeds here. He described this. It's not a picture. Two bundles of reeds leaning up against each other. For instance, they're staying up because they're leaning. If one falls, the other will fall down, is the idea. I remember one of the first Madhyamaka teachings I got from my teacher. We were very young, like 21. And my teacher said to me, he put his fingers together like this and he said, "Lizzie, is this one or two?" And I said, "Well, Ramsha," you know, I didn't have any idea why he would be asking me such a weird question. But I said, "I think it's not one because there's two parts. But you can't say it's two either because it's like making one shape." And then it took me 10, 15 years to figure out what that had to do with spiritual development. But anyway, it's the same principle. This leaning thing is very important here. Can we find anything that stands alone? So to do this investigation, It's kind of going to be a commentary on a quote by Carl Sagan. So Carl Sagan, somewhere in the 1970s, said, if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you'll have to invent the entire universe. An entire universe or something. If you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you first have to invent the universe. So the question is, do you think it's possible to make anything from scratch? And do you need an entire universe to make an apple pie? So I'm going to go over this with you, and we can see if that's possible. It's a great way to look at autonomy or independence, or if that's even possible. So in the good old days, everybody made pies from scratch, you hear, I've heard. Sometimes we still do, and when we do, everybody appreciates them more because it kind of signifies, well, you've put a little extra care, you haven't been lazy. And old-fashioned means kind of romantic for us. So in the old days, everybody made pies from scratch. And then I looked this up, in the 30s or 40s, somebody invented the first pie crust box mix, something. So, you know, as the mixes, you have to add a few things like oil and maybe eggs or something. So maybe not for pie crust. I don't think pie crust has eggs. But water and oil, probably. And then in the 1950s, Betty Crocker became very popular, and pie crusts and cake mixes became, everybody was using them, and it was supposed to be this big liberating thing for housewives. So there you have to add oil and probably eggs. Anyway, but even if you were to make a pie from scratch now, what I want to ask is, does making a pie where you mix all the pie crust ingredients together by yourself and not use a package mix constitute making a pie from scratch? What do you think?
Oh, it's different levels. Like at one level, yes, but you're not actually growing the wheat.
Yes, that's right. So if you want to make a pie from scratch, you have to buy some land. And some farming equipment, or at least a horse and a plow, and you have to set up an irrigation system, and you have to buy some seeds. So, if you planted the seeds, and you cultivated them, and you had all the causes and conditions that you need for that to happen, like sun and no drought, or, you know, the weather conditions have to be good, and say you hold the wheat, and you... What is that thing where you separate the husk from the grain?
Threshing.
You thresh the grain, then you get the grains and you grind them, and then you make your pie crust. Would that constitute making a pie from scratch? We haven't even got to the apples yet. Even still, if we just focus on the wheat, let's say. Yeah, if we just focus on the wheat, like every single wheat seed has its own history. I think. Yeah? And if you start to look into wheat, it's very interesting. I did. I looked a little bit into wheat, like the history of wheat, and historians say that wheat came from the Levant region of the Near East, kind of around the Fertile Crescent. That's where it grew. So somebody must have been walking along, and they see these high grasses with these big seeds, or thinking there are seeds or whatever in them. And then noticed that the animals, I mean, this is conjecture, I have no idea, but seemed that they weren't poisonous because maybe animals were eating them, and like had to figure out this whole thing of how to use it, grind it, and then this whole idea of bread. That's all already miraculous right there. And of course, we needed all the causes and conditions back then, like the water and the soil and the, you know, sun and all this kind of stuff. And then I'm sure there's all kinds of politics around the distribution of land and wheat and, you know, all of that. Like, now today we have all the GMO stuff. But the wheat's changed also, what I've heard is wheat has changed, just the chemical compounds of wheat have changed so much, even to this present day. And now they have all kinds of wheat, too, that they're trying to create without also GMOs, like, everybody has gluten problems right now. So, you know, there's all kinds of things changing around the world of wheat, you know. So, you know, I always think, well, you could spend your entire life just focusing on wheat and never exhaust a topic. Eternity. And that's because if you look at any one thing, you find a world of infinite contingency. Like, you could go on forever. Not that you'd want to. But it's amazing that that's the case, you know? So things will keep opening up and opening up, and you'll have all kinds of stories and adventures, and you'll never reach a definitive conclusion about wheat. Because wheat is not limited to the ideas you have about it. Just this limited idea of wheat. It will continue to open because it's part of everything else. And then we have, I guess you could say, the apples. When I heard this quote, my friend sent me this quote, and I thought it was a really great way to talk about interdependence. And one year I thought, well, after my friend sent me the quote, I thought, I want to learn to make an apple pie. So I decided that I was going to I called my friend Peggy, who leads cooking tours in Morocco and Italy in different places, and she gives me cooking classes every August. So it was almost August, and it was almost my dad's birthday, and he's like the biggest apple pie lover of anyone I've ever met. And I just thought, well, maybe she can come and help me make some homemade apple pie for my dad. So she came, and we had this plan. And one thing that was interesting is that the night before, I looked outside at my apple tree, and it was loaded with apples. So I was going to harvest the next morning my apples and use them, you know, for the pie. And then when I woke up in the morning, a bear had come, and I hadn't seen this, but completely ravaged it. Like, they break, this one now I understand, they break off the branches and they just go like that. And then my tree, which was getting quite big, it had one little branch left sticking up, and then at the very tippy top, a tiny little apple dangling there. Which I left, because I always leave one piece of fruit for my trees. I have a plum tree, some plum trees too. I leave, as you know, because they deserve it. So then I thought, well, the universe is conspiring against me. So then I thought, well, what will I do? And I just thought, well, don't make a big deal, and just go down to the local place at my local store and buy a bag of organic apples from my town. We have lots of apple trees in my town. So it all worked out, and Peggy came, and we made all kinds of apple pies, like so many shapes and sizes, and like with different kinds of spices. And sometimes we kneaded the dough, and sometimes we put it in the food processor, and we compared notes. It was like this huge day of like chemistry experiment. It was really, really good, and it smelled so good in my house. And so then I thought, well, we had about 7 pies, I think, and they're all different. Like, I love those rustic kinds, like European kind, where you just put the fruit in and then you fold it up. They're really pretty. But I thought my dad would like old-fashioned kind, and we made this one where you make those dough leaves, mm-hmm. leaves made out of dough shape, mm-hmm. and you put it on the top. It was so pretty, and you pinch the sides. And so I had this one, and I thought it was so beautiful, and I couldn't believe that I could make such a beautiful apple pie. And I thought, I was proud of myself. And then I thought, wait a minute. Carl Sagan says, it takes an entire universe. So I couldn't get too bloated about it, too arrogant about it, because I was remembering his words. And I thought that was very interesting. You know, it's not even a linear process. It's not like there's one recipe, one person to execute it, you know, one oven, one pie. It's not a linear process at all. Isn't that interesting? We think of time as linear. But actually, when we look, first of all, there's no single origin for anything. Mm-hmm. And it's what we consider a continuum is not really a linear process at all. So this blows also the last investigation away in a certain kind of interesting, you know, we're looking for this linear continuum.
It's got the future in it, too, because
yeah.
an apple pie has to be eaten. That's part of the apple pie.
You bet. Mm. You bet. I agree. And it was. My dad loved it. Yeah. So you know, we tend to think in a line, but when we look closer, we see this web of infinite contingency is the point. So nothing is a closed system. And it does take an entire universe to make a pie. So I always feel, okay, Carl Sagan is really asking us, where does an apple pie end and the world begin? You know what I mean? And can you say that the world and an apple pie are one? Not exactly. But can you say they're two? Not exactly. Do you see some pattern happening here? Like, you can't say something is singular, but you can't say it's many. You can't say something is permanent, but you can't say it's impermanent either. You can't say that things are one, but you can't together, but you can't say they're separate either. In fact, you can't find a separate thing, something you call a thing. We can call it an apple pie, that's no problem, but we know there's way more to it than that. And what's beautiful about this is it takes you out of a sense of vagueness, because what I thought about an apple pie before all of this and what I thought about an apple pie after doing this investigation, when I looked at that apple pie, I had so much appreciation and gratitude for the entire universe that went in to be, that's a part of it, you know? And so you can't say, oh, it's a void, it's empty, as not in terms of like it, thinking it's non-existent. In fact, there's nothing vague. It can't be a whatever, as you were saying last night. You know, nowadays she was saying kids are always saying whatever. It's not a whatever. There's something very precise about this. There's something very you can't even say true, in precise as in true, but it's very rich.
Is this what's meant by Buddha's omniscience?
Yes. Actually, that's an amazing question that you bring this in right now. Because what if somebody asked me recently, what does enlightenment mean? Of course, that's a really lofty question. But I actually think that's a fair question. What does liberation mean? What happens? So I'll tell you how they talk about it in the Uttara Tantra Shastra. You've heard of that, right? They say that the Buddha's has two ways of have two aspects. His mind or the wisdom of the Buddha has two aspects. One is that when it knows the nature of all phenomena. So in other words, the nature is when you look into anything, it's like a rainbow. You can't find anything intrinsically existent there. You can't locate it. You can't find any intrinsic qualities to it. It keeps opening. So that's the wisdom of, like, emptiness, or what do they call it? The nature of how things are is the translation of it. Jitawa is called the nature of how things are. It's like the view of things, the true essence. And the other aspect of the nature is that you see everything arises independent on other things. And that's, like, what we consider omniscient, or just seeing the intricacy of how things fit together. We tend to think of that in a kind of coarse way, like, well, the Buddha saw, you know, what I ate for breakfast this morning, or I don't know if it works like that or not, but there's, I don't know, I'm sure you all have had some sense of feeling like the order, like a kind of deep sense of feeling in good relationship with the world around you, you know, and moving through the world, knowing who you are. Which has a lot to do with this, knowing who you are in relationship. So that's what they say, that's the jinipa, the understanding the manyness of things. So understanding how things are, and these are not two separate things. Okay, I might throw in something difficult, and you just let it sit there. Maybe you'll understand it right away. But when we're talking about emptiness, and like in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, or what have you, we have a tendency to want to divide those two things. Like, it's empty, when we look, it's empty, and then over here it's like, oh, the relative world that we have to live in and relate to. But it's really because everything is in relationship that it's empty. Use the word because. Because everything leans, you can't find an intrinsicness to, or thingness or an intrinsic boundary for anything. And yet, you can also say, because it's empty, everything can arise. For example, if things weren't empty, they'd be inert, they'd be static, they wouldn't be in relationship. So the world of appearances and possibilities wouldn't even occur. So this is a very important, I mean, this gets at the crux of the whole thing, but we're still kind of in the middle of the investigation, but it came up, so what to do? Had to respond. So I feel that this Carl Sagan's, it's almost like a provocation for me, you know, or a challenge. It's not really about apple pie. I sometimes feel like it has more, it's more asking us to look at who we are in the nature of interdependence, in the nature of relationship. For example, you could do the same investigation on yourself, like where do I end and my world begin? You know, you could start looking at the origin of you. Like sometimes you could, you know, for me, I think, okay, I'll look at my parents, like they met at UCLA, their friends introduced them. What happened if the friends didn't introduce them? What would have happened if their friends didn't introduce them? Or what if they didn't like each other, mm-hmm. you know? Or you can look into the whole realm of your biology and what has to happen for you to get your, make it through the gestation period and the birth process and all of that, you know. I always think, I have one of those books that shows like the different stages, the zygotes and all this, and the fetus in the womb. And there's this whole thing about like, if that one tenacious sperm turned left instead of right, it would have gone up the wrong tube and nothing would have happened. And then the egg has to not reject it. You know, like there's all this stuff that has to happen, like all these causes and conditions that are so intricate. It's like a whole other world, a universe, you know. But lo and behold, you know, here we are. It's so interesting. And so we think we can just say who we are. But we can't even say where we end and the world begins, which I think is a very important clue to really understanding who we are. Because it means, you know, we can't really get bloated about who we are because everything we do is dependent on other things. And yet we can't really be puny either because we're part of this great nature of interdependence. We're not in total command because we only ever see a little piece of things. And we don't have total control. And we can't fix it all, which is kind of a something that we fall into. And yet everything we do, because we're in relationship with everything else, everything we do has reverberating effects. Everything we do matters. And so all of a sudden, we realize we have to watch our conduct very, very carefully. This is what this means for us. So we can't say, as an excuse this word, but I don't know what else to use, an ontological truth to our being. Like, I am this, or I am that. You know, we can't say who we are as some kind of existent thing. But I always think we can say we know who we are in relationship to other things. So we can say, I can say, I feel very confident I know who I am in the sense of, I know I can't control the world. I know I can't fix everything. I know I can't bring things to a static state of perfect equilibrium. I know I don't know why certain things are the way they are or where they're going to go, you know? There's so much mystery, and that keeps me feeling very humble and open. At the same time, I can see that everything I do matters. And so, conduct is very important. Motivation is very important, you know? So like the meteorologist Edward Lorenz asks, you know, does a butterfly in Brazil fluttering its wings create a tornado in Texas or something? Like, we're part of this unbelievably intricate, fragile, or I don't know, fragile, delicate, like sensitive is what I'm thinking, system where everything matters, what we do. And yet we can't say where it's going to go, what we do, either. So this is where we are. And I feel like, I think about this, and where I was last, they asked me to talk about confidence, the topic of confidence. And I think this brings a lot of confidence. Because really, we can never know who we are, and when we're always trying to look for who we are, we kind of back ourselves into a corner. Because we're always changing, we're not singular or many, permanent or impermanent, we're not the same or separate. But what we can understand ourselves in is in who we are in relationship, in responding constantly to the world that we're in relationship with. And that, you know, is grace. Like ego and holding on to ego and contraction is the opposite of grace. It's awkward, you know? Like Kong Trumshe, my teacher, always says, ego is always uncomfortable. You know, when it's in a position of authority or kind of a higher position, it feels kind of arrogant and bloated. When it's lower, we feel diminished. The self feels diminished. When it's on the same level as others, we are always poised to compete, you know, with them. It's always feeling uncomfortable. But when we understand that we are just part of this great nature of interdependence, we find some kind of grace in that. We find some kind of natural grace. And I don't mean grace in some kind of, you know, Christian way, although maybe, who knows what any Christian person means when they say this, but we know what graceful is. We know what gracious is. We know what it means to not be awkward. So this holding on to truths and beliefs about who we are and who others are is an impediment to this kind of grace or this kind of confidence or knowing who we are. So in this way, I feel that these contemplations are very powerful. And I feel like the more we do them, the more we engage them, the more we can understand who we are, but not as some static, solid, permanent, impermanent, independent thing, but as a part of this great nature of interdependence. So we actually were able to do two contemplations in one session. I've never done this before, but we do have some time for discussion. So there's a lot of juice in these topics. So yeah, please do feel free to ask or comment, share insight. I see a hand in the back. Hi. Sorry, about grief?
You mentioned grief, and I guess the thing that I think about in the work that I do is when someone dies, when is the moment of death?
We were just talking about that. Yeah. Do you work with people in that field? Or?
I work with premature babies and sick newborns in intensive care.
Wow.
One of the things that's fascinating to me is that all it takes is one chromosome, one piece of the chromosome not coming together and self-replication, and you have a baby that is not compatible with life, and it's quite profound, the impact that that has. And so then all of us, all those things took place the way they were supposed to take place. And here we are all seemingly appearing to be normal, and yet there's variation in that. Like you would look at take it back, the genes, and what does that mean? All of that genetic stuff. But, for me, just recently, dealing with death, and when does it happen?
Yeah, you bet. It's a very profound question. Because, on the, if you watch any of those shows on TV, like hospital shows, they're always like, time of death, da 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 da. But it's true, and actually, we were just talking about this today, earlier. Yeah, that's a very poignant moment, but it's not a moment that you can actually determine. And, you know, someone like in the Tibetan tradition, it's not just in the Tibetan tradition, I think. Sometimes people's bodies are warm for a very long time. Sometimes one organ continues to work or another organ doesn't continue. Or like one person, a doctor once told me, it's very hard to determine because half of your cells are not even your own. Like they're foreign, like microbes and all these things that come into your body. 50%? I mean, that's what he said. I thought, wow, that's quite a lot. You know, they don't have any of your DNA structure in them, but they're alive and they make up, especially in your intestinal tract, there must be tremendous amounts of microbes and things like that. We have this, you know, it's all very much without checking carefully, but, you know, sometimes you have to put it on a certificate or the moment of birth. You know, of course, that's an odd one because the baby was there the whole time. So how can you really, you know what I mean? And then what does that mean exactly? But, yeah, these are all such interesting and subtle questions. But it's so magical that way, too. And death is such a poignant, deep, you know, we have just this tendency to be very freaked out about it or have these really gross concepts about what it is. And then if you begin to practice and then you spend time around those kinds of situations, you find, oh, it's quite different than you thought it was. And it's really hard to know what to say about it sometimes. And yes, the time of death would be very hard to pinpoint. That you don't really see something change from existence to non-existence. And what does that mean, you know? These things are, then when you start to look, I think it lightens things and it makes you curious and... you know, if we can't even find how we exist, what does it mean to not exist? You know, many questions come from this, these kinds of investigations. And that's why, you know, Nagarjuna says, you know, like a dream. I have to sing it now. If like an illusion. How does it go, Phil? That's a dream, like an illusion. Like a city of Gandharvas, that's all birth, and that's all living, that's all dying, our hope to be. Yeah, I like that so much. Yeah, so that's why Nagarjuna said that. And that's why the Karmapa said nothing happens. Like it's an illusion. It doesn't mean in some way, on one level there's a change. On one level it's like they say it's like from one walking from one room to another. Because you're not clinging to something as real, then there's not the extinction. You know, if something's real, it all has to become extinct. But maybe the whole way we look at things and the whole way we look at death is not exactly how things are. You know, we're looking in a very dualistic way at our minds and, you know, what existence means and what we're holding on when we say existence. And that's why, yeah, this has a lot to do, you know, with understanding how we live and how we die. And so this is very valuable. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much for all your enthusiasm. It's very inspiring.
Of course.
I remember when you first wrote your book and you gave a presentation, I had no really idea what you were talking about. So I feel a little bit that I have a little more understanding. But my thinking is the magic that you talk about, to be able to work with that in a very practical way. Mm-hmm. And for me, when I receive these teachings, I get fired up and then like, okay, what is it? Or how can I apply what mm-hmm. I've been learning? Mm-hmm. And to think of, yeah. And we've done a lot of contemplation, and perhaps it's for me to think about, well, how do I want to sit and have things unfold for me, or what do I want to dig deeper into, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering if you had any suggestion on just how to begin. Maybe it's going back to your book.
Yeah.
I don't know what the help, but just one simple takeaway or simple
you bet. It's a great question. Yeah. Well, sometimes, you know, when I feel, I don't know, I'm going throughout my day, and then I feel a little bit of edginess. Sometimes I don't even know what comes from. Kind of a, you know, edgy or a jagged feeling. Do you know what I mean? Everybody knows. Oh, it wasn't just me. So there's a little bit of jaggedness. And, like, sometimes you just assume, oh, you just kind of keep going. Like, you just assume you have to have that's there. And there's, but I stop, kind of don't assume that anymore a lot of the time. And I sit down somewhere, and I look at it, and I try to find the edges. I try to find the boundary. I try to find, like, is it singular? And I start to look at it, and I think, just like I was saying about grief, you see so many things. It's full of experience. It starts to come alive, and it starts to soften. It's as simple as that. And it's like it's pleasure. Like you were saying, it's kind of like there's a pleasure. I think this is a very pleasurable practice. And I do it a lot with my physical body, but I also do it with my thoughts because things just feel really jagged sometimes. And then I look, and there's also a lot of concepts sometimes in it. Like, I'll hear something, and the concept is, I don't even realize that this particular concept is making me feel jagged. So first I'll even look at the concept, and I'll remember, you know, this is just a concept. And I start to look into the concept and open it up that way. Very simple. And do look at practices. You know, at first with practice, we have to plow through it a little bit. Or, you know, it can be very agitating to investigate because we're not used to investigating in this way. So sometimes when people start to investigate, it's like they just don't, they feel agitated, I guess. But once you start learning how to do this, you actually realize how enjoyable it is. And each time you look and you're not finding, it kind of just opens up, like, you don't have to hold so tight. Sometimes when you go to body work, it's like this. You know, the point is, you know, you're holding something in your tissue and somebody's trying to encourage you, let go, let go. And it just kind of softens and opens up. And this is so wonderful because, you know, also you can use your conceptual mind. You can really appreciate your conceptual mind. Like even labeling things, oh, I see this, I see that. But you don't have to think of it as true. And so there's room for it all to be there. You know, there's no getting rid of or judging or anything like that. It's just we're looking into the nature of what we assumed it was. And we're saying, oh, it's not really that. You know? Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah.
Elizabeth, is this always, for you, an investigation? Or is there, it seems like sometimes there's just this resting, just this pause.
Yeah.
As you're going throughout the day.
Yeah, I, you know, it stops, sometimes it just comes very naturally. I don't, you know, you all study more mudra, and in my tradition we study a little more like Dzogchen. It's really on the verge of being that. You know, you like they say in the Dzogchen tradition, I can talk to you about this because you've been practicing for a long time, like a snake is in a knot and it just unknots itself. Every moment is like that, like opening, like an unknotting of something. So sometimes sometimes it just turns into just, the mind is just, it keeps free, it keeps freeing itself, or it has this feeling of continuous kind of being able to rest and not grasping and rejecting things. So I think that it's like a fine line between doing, for me, doing these investigations and doing more of a Vajrayana, we call formless practice, because you're not focusing on an object, but just looking into the nature of something, and it opens up like that. I know, I mean, I always had a little bit of trouble drawing the line between these two traditions. I just think, like, a lot of people look at Majjhimaka as being really intellectual, only for scholars, and I really don't think it's meant to be that. I think it's meant to be experiential. And when I read like Longchenpa, who's, you know, kind of the man in our, the chief, you know, in our tradition, really important. And his writings are incredible. And he seemed to have like the most profound of the profound, like the highest word, like use of words, the most subtle language to express this. But it's, he's always referring back to the Madhyamakans, and he's using that kind of language often in making that connection. So,
yeah, I was sort of thinking about how we are skillful with our own mind in terms of,
yeah.
I wasn't even thinking of putting those labels of whether it's Dzogchen or Mahamudra or whatever.
Yeah, say
but
more.
Just in terms of knowing when we need to sort of look a little bit or poke, not poke, but sort of investigate a little bit our experience, and other times just be there.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, if you're resting with experience, you just feel just you're there, then there's no need to do this, you know. This just leads to that, so you don't have to go backwards. But it is, but actually sometimes it's just to see how amazing things are and to revel in like the amazingness of the, all of this, you could do it. And you sing like a dream. That's like a song of realization,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yesterday you started out talking about, I think one of the first things you said was something about faith.
Oh.
And I was just wondering if you could come back to that word, since that's where you started. I'm just curious if you could tease that out a little bit.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot about this. I'm writing a book called The Logic of Faith, which is kind of a combination of these two, you know, the tradition of Majjhimaka and, you know, the fact that we can't know anything in a determinate way, like we can't capture anything in thought, that it always will always elude us, that we can't find anything, you know, like through the three investigations, means we can't really know anything in a determinate way. You know, we can't capture it with a concept. So in that way, we have no choice but to faith, I feel. We often think, you know, faith, I said this last night, right? We associate it with like dogma and fundamentalism and all of this. But the fact is that we have no choice because we don't know. But then there's some kind of ability to rest with that. And I think Majjhimaka is all about that. Like you're looking and you're not finding. And yet there's some sort of... you're very protected when you understand this. Like the open question is very protected because you're not shutting down around ideas or becoming like fundamentalist or rigid. And yet you're engaged fully. It's a place of confidence. Like we're saying, you know who you are, you know, in the scheme of things. So to me, that means somehow connected to faith, because it's not a mind, or it's not based on having to know something in that rigid kind of way, or that clinging to the insecurities, actually. Like when they say, when you have a lot of beliefs about yourself or the world, there's so much insecurity. Chandrakirti said, we're like these monkeys, like a monkey in a tree. Like we grab at a branch and it breaks, and we grab at another branch and it breaks, and we grab at another branch. We're always trying to confirm or affirm or hold on to views, you know? So there's a tremendous insecurity in the way that we live. So this way, that the faith, to me, has a sense of conviction. Sometimes we use the word faith of, like confidence or conviction, or it has a sense of the ability to find ease in the fact that we don't know. Because it has those two elements in it, ease or confidence, and yet you wouldn't have to have faith if you already knew, you know. But we've never really reached definitive conclusions. So it's, I think for me, faith is a word that really has to do with looking at the human condition and understanding how to live with that. And so that's why I think this path is kind of like a path that has to do with faith. Yeah, sure. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how to describe this, but when you were talking in the first, discussing the first practice we did today, one of the things that struck me, and I'd like you to comment on this, is what it really comes down to is it makes us aware we have a choice, the choice of suffering or not. You know, I mean, we can, if we're in the moment, we have an ability to choose. Could you sort of expand on that? Or
I think we talked about that today, too, a little bit. Like, that's a great question. Boy, there's a lot you could say about this. You know, sometimes I think maybe we don't, if we're not practicing, we don't have a choice. That's the interest. I think practice is what gives us a choice. Mm-hmm. This kind of investigation gives us a choice. Like, if things are real, then we're kind of doomed and we don't have a choice. So, like, when we're tripping over our spouse's laundry or whatever, you know, if we burn ourselves enough through reacting, you know, and we start to question, or we start to do these investigations and we start to question, there'll be a pause there. Like, we will have a choice. But I think that, you know, on this path, it's a process of refinement. Like, how does cause and effect work? How do we create our suffering? You know, what kind of motivation do we have? Like, we're checking all these things. And then we're checking, like, how real are things? And it opens up a world of possibility and choice. Like, we start making really informed choices about things with a lot of clarity. Otherwise, we're just kind of, like we say, vague and reacting to things. When we start to identify and look at what, you know, how we're creating these kind of difficulties for ourselves and the belief systems that we hold, we don't have much choice. Thubten Urgyen once said, it's kind of like he was saying in Tibet, many people have diabetes, but they don't really know that if they have insulin, they don't have to die. Like, if they drink some juice or something like that. Like, just that bit of information makes a tremendous amount of difference. I think for us, we have some information here, and the Dharma is giving us some information on how to live and what kind of choices. Like, if we want to be happy, you know, we have to do certain things. You know, and we all seem to want to be happy and free from suffering. That in the text, you know, how they say this is an indication that we have Buddha nature. Like, we just have this natural propensity to want to be happy. But we don't know how to make our actions meet our intentions for happiness. So this is an education, but it's not just an education someone telling you. It's like you have to find out for yourself through investigation. And then all of a sudden, we start to see, oh, this is how we bring our actions together with our intentions. And then that's called wisdom, you know, intelligence. So I think we create choice that way. And so there is the importance for hearing wisdom, like to study the teachings, bringing them to your own experience through contemplation, and then practice. They say the three wisdoms, you know, we apply the three wisdoms. That way. Yeah, that's a great question.
Seems like any time you've reached a conclusion about anything, that's a red flag.
Yeah. I think so. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I do feel that.
Yeah, tell me how it makes you feel when you have reached a conclusion. Because,
well, yeah. it seems so fixed. It's almost like you have no choice but to think that forever. Mm-hmm. It's like that conclusion. Or
yeah.
Even if it's for, it's just, it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable. I often think, like, when the thing I cherish most about people is this kind of openness and curiosity. And the thing that I have the hardest time with is, like, knowers. I notice for myself. And I also recognize when I'm a knower, and I really don't appreciate that part of my mind. It feels kind of sleazy. And it really does. Like, I don't trust it at all. And I always say, like, you know, being stuck at, like, a dinner party or something where you have to talk to a knower, and then there's all this information coming at you, and you almost can't even listen to it. And sometimes in those situations, I think, well, what to do? sometimes if it doesn't seem too rude, I just ask, really? Do you think that? Like, just to show that it's an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not truth. Oh, really? Oh, that's an interesting way of looking at it. But sometimes, like, when I'm a knower, like, say at that dinner party, I'm the knower. And the next morning I wake up, it's like having a hangover. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't appreciate that of myself. Yeah. I really love this open quality of open investigation. It's the best approach for everything. If you want to ask somebody a question, that you don't have to give a comment. If you comment, you'll insult them. But if you simply ask them a question, they can look at their own mind and see what, and open it up. Like my teacher, Kong Trubache, said, the best I can ever do is get students to self-reflect. And I go by that. I think that's what I've found to be true. And he's gotten me to do that. And like, so it opens up your life, you know. And it's kind. Because, in fact, that would be great if we could help others do that, too. People are really stuck. But if you start telling them, oh, you have this problem and that problem, then that's really hard to take. People don't even know how to self-reflect on that without beating themselves up. But if you suggest, well, what do you think about this? Or, you know, how do you feel about that? Or have you noticed this? Or I've noticed this. Have you noticed? You know, then it just breathes some life into that situation or that person's consciousness. So. Yeah.
This is a strange, not a question, but I'd like you to say something about your parents. Your parents you talk about often when you speak, and you haven't talked about them much this time. And they're extraordinary people in their support of you.
Yeah. Oh, that's so
sweet.
They're
almost more extraordinary than you.
Yeah.
Sine qua non.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear how they're doing.
That's so sweet of you to ask that, really. I'm going to tell them when I get home. Yeah. Well, my parents live close to me, a few miles away. My dad's almost 85. He's always been a bit of a maverick, very kind of rebellious guy, really strong political. My dad has a lot of strong views in a certain way, but he's very playful and very warm. Kind of somebody who likes to enjoy life a lot, even when it's not so good for him in certain ways. but we've decided that we just let him freely do that. 85. He's 85. He's great. He's really great. He's so much fun. He's so much fun. He was in the music business in Hollywood for a long time. And I was just, I don't know, was it Peter? I was telling you, yeah. He used to take me out. I was telling Eric last night, because he knew a lot of famous musicians and stuff, and I used to come to his office, and it was a big treat, and some of these famous singers or whatever, and they'd be having their little business meeting, and he always said, eat dessert first. He'd always let me eat dessert first, because he said, you might be too full after dinner to have dessert, so eat dessert first. That's my dad. And then my mom... My mom is a longtime Dharma practitioner, a student of Dundra Rinpoche and Gyaltra Rinpoche, in the Nyingma tradition, Payul Nyingma tradition. She's extremely discerning, sharp, little wrathful, complete opposite of my dad. Dessert did not get eaten first, if at all. As a matter of fact, it's all I think, when I think of my mom, I think of, like, eat your greens, which I still do. She taught me really good health habits, and she always made sure we went to really good schools, and she, very caring, very discerning person, but strict, kind of strict, but very supportive of my spiritual search. very supportive, really paying attention from when I was small, that I had this proclivity, and my brother too, proclivity for understanding something deeper, and always nourished that. I was very lucky. I feel lucky. It's really sweet of you to ask. And she's 78 next month. And we're all really close, and we all live near each other. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. That's such a sweet that you asked that. Really. Yeah. Amy, how about you? Did it touch on what you're asking? Do you feel you still have a lingering question?
Not a lot. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah. Oh, good.
I think that I have a lot of concepts.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to figure out, and you said, you know, let the concepts come.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent. To see that we have a lot of concepts and that the concepts are a little bit vague is really very unusual in and of itself.
I think I'm still looking for these things.
Keep looking.
They're like parts of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Like Phil said, there's the resting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just like awareness?
Mm-hmm.
Am I making that into a thing? And then there's the analytic meditation.
Yeah. Yeah, just keep practicing.
Yeah.
It'll become clear. But you'll never make, like, the minute you make anything a thing,
Then
that's not seeing it directly. That's seeing it through your map, making a map of it. So that's why Nagarjuna said, and it's important you brought this up, you know, even clinging to emptiness as a truth is the greatest of all the mistakes. Because seeing things as empty is freeing. But the moment you make it a truth, you kind of, what do you say, ruin the antidote, which is seeing the nature and that opening that happens. So it just becomes a dogma, which, you know, we're all in have trouble with that. But it's okay to talk about emptiness or interdependence or all these things using the words. It's just words. We don't have to see the words as something true. But you know you're starting to see them true. What does it feel like when it turns into dogma for you? This is a good question. What happens when you have this kind of openness or this interest and all of a sudden it becomes into a truth or you become right? What does it feel like?
Anxiety.
Anxious, insecure, or tight, righteous. Mm-hmm. I feel sometimes like... You know, that fiery thing happens. I know. I don't know.
It's like I'm looking for something instead of just looking at it.
Yeah.
That's
a lot of the confusion that people have, is that you're looking for a conclusion, but there won't be one. So you always have to ask yourself, can I bear that? Can I bear it? It's like fractals. You know fractals, those computer images where wherever you put the cursor, it opens up into another image that's kind of similar, like a mathematical graphic image. And then you put it somewhere else and it opens into another, you know, image. But this is kind of how the mind, this is how our life is. It's like, think of Terry Gross, you know. I love her.
I have a question about that. I mean, do we have to, like, what is the advantage of asking, like, can I bear it? I mean,
what is the image you said?
What is the advantage?
Well, because sometimes, like, for example, somebody does something you don't like, and immediately you reach a conclusion. In fact, it's very intelligent to be able to see many aspects of situations. That's maybe what we call intelligence. That's one form of fundamentalism. You see a person who arises due to infinite causes and conditions and is like part of this world of infinite contingency. You don't know how things are going to kind of progress or change. And you only have your one kind of, you only see a very little piece of things. and you reach a conclusion about who this person is an ontological truth, is an existent truth, is not an accurate assessment of what things are. You know? And that's how all negative emotions arise from doing that. Like I said in my book, I thought this was like an example that I can continue to use for some reason. Well, not for some reason. I think it's very helpful. Like when people are trained to go into a war, they're trained to objectify the enemy. If you look in someone's eyes and you think, oh, this is someone's brother, this is someone's father, you know, this is someone's son, and you look at their humanness and they start to become kind of a, not just a one-dimensional thing, it's very hard to kill people. That's why they say in order to kill their people, kind of objectify you in some kind of way. So negative emotions and attachment too comes from that. You see someone is completely perfect. Well, no one is completely how you think they should be. You know, so you have this one-dimensional image of them. And so the attachment stays strong that way. But nothing is like that. Things are infinitely complex. And you can have a relationship with someone where they've done something very painful to you, and you can not forget that, but you can also see that they've done wonderful things for you, that you love this person, that you can hold a lot of complexity. That's more sophisticated, but that's what we have to develop. Not to shut down in this very puny way, based on this one idea we have, thinking we can capture anything that way. You know? Things are, like Gunther says, open dimensional, not one dimensional. Meaning, everybody who looks at one thing will see something different, and it will always be changing and dynamic and in relationship with other things. So, yeah, one more. I think, do we have time for one more? Amy, we want to ask one more question quickly?
I just wanted to say that something that helped me, Kongkhar Rinpoche put something on his Facebook page a few months ago that really helped me, and he said, it was something like, We shouldn't try to achieve something with our Dharma practice.
Mm.
We should just wake up we should resolve to practice until we die. This is the best way. And it brought me face to face with my motivation in a really strong way.
Yeah.
Oh, if I'm trying to become enlightened or I'm trying to be a good student, there's this kind of really shady motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Started to relax.
Mm.
I realized how much there was a lot of ego there and a lot of tension.
Yeah,
that was getting like it was like dumping a bunch of junk into my practice every day.
Yeah,
and it has really actually that comment has really stuck with me, and I was thinking maybe that's what's happening when I'm trying to do these analytic meditations. That I feel like I have to do this, or I have to get somewhere with this, or I have to come out with something. With this. And then that. It's like a setup for failure, really.
Yeah.
And then you're afraid of the failure.
Right.
And then forget about enjoying your mind.
Yeah. It's not very enjoyable. Yeah. That's
like
a, yeah.
It's like these big bags of rocks along with you.
Yeah. It's actually utterly simple. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sometimes too simple for us. It's just but when you start doing it, you'll really enjoy it. This is an incredibly enjoyable practice. That's my experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope it's that for you. That's my wish. So, anyway. Yeah, thank you all very much. Yeah.
Can we do the closing prayers, the last two pages?
Surrounded by snow mountains, is a source
of complete happiness and benefit.
Attendant Jamsa, may your stand firm until the end of existence.
Unborn,
eternal self arising Dharmakaya arises as the miraculous kayas of form. May the three secrets of the Karmapa be stable in the Vajra nature. and may his limitless Buddha activity spontaneously blaze.
Splendor of the teachings, Karma Lojo,
may you attain steadfast. Your qualities of the glorious and excellent Dharma increase to fill space. May your lotus feet always be stable, and may your Buddha activity of teaching and practice blaze victoriously in all directions. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free.
Thank you.